Welcome to this special Luminous Union meeting for everybody who wants to at this retreat. We're very glad to have Rob Brink with us again. I failed to bring with me the title sheet.
The title we settled on was Winnow, Sift, and Simmer.
Simmer.
Yes.
The hidden value of
the seminary education.
Right.
Huh. Yeah.
And something I've been curious about for a number of years. We've had contract ministers who spoke and never discussed what their seminary training brought to us as a congregation with a lot of atheists and humanists.
Right.
So
that's it.
You've got a lot of books here today, Rob. Thanks for coming.
Timely discussion.
Well, it's very nice to meet y'all. Like you said, my name is Rob. I do have a seminary education. I graduated from Minnesota Bible College, Rochester, Minnesota. That's where I did my undergrad. Got my master's degree from the University of Dubuque Theological Seminary in Dubuque, Iowa. And I was a paid professional clergy person for 15 years. So I do have some experience to share from that side of things. And after 15 years of moving further and further theologically left, I sort of fell off the table and became a humanist. I self-identify as a humanist. And these are the books that I still have with me. There used to be many, many more. Some of them have walked away, and these are the ones that I could, like, carry with me. I still have more at home. But in the process of leaving the faith, I definitely left some of those books behind. So what you see in front of you is a sampling of the pieces of that education and the pieces of that life that still bring value to me, and that's why I wanted to share them with you. So one of the things that you pick up when you go to Jesus Camp Bible College is a whole lot of history, biblical history in specific, but world history in general. So anybody familiar with the concept of winnowing?
Okay. So, sifting and winnowing.
Right. So winnowing is a leftover from a pre-industrial age. We'd go plant the wheat grows, but the wheat, the only part of it that we eat is the tiny little kernel. And outside the kernel, there's a shell that isn't really useful to us, kind of like a peanut, but much lighter. So what they would do is they'd take the wheat and they would bang it on the ground to knock the kernels loose, and then they would agitate it so that the kernels are rubbing against each other, and they would rub that shell loose, that extra cellulose on the outside. And they would take the whole thing and throw it up in the air, and the wind would take what they called the chaff. It was so light, the wind would take it away, and the kernels that we could still eat that would eventually become flour would fall back into the basket or the blanket or whatever. They do it again, agitate it and shake it, throw it in the air, agitate it, shake it, throw it in the air. And the wind gradually would pull that extra chaff away. So you're separating the wheat from the chaff. For me, that happened when I tried to live out my education in real life and realized that some of it was wheat and some of it was chaff. There were things that just didn't work in real life, like sexism and homophobia, which are fairly prominent in some branches of Christianity, but just don't work when you want to actually impact people. What did work was respect and listening. What did work was laughter. So that was the wheat that I was able to hold on to as we winnowed out the chaff. So that brings us to sifting. Sifting is when you just like sit on the beach. When I was a kid, I collect rocks, still collect rocks. And my favorite thing was I would get a sifter, and I'd just dig into the sand and just shake it. There's something satisfying about just shaking it, and all the sand falls through the sieve, and all that's left are the rocks, and you pick out the pretty ones. So after I'd blown away the stuff that was pretty much useless, I went through a period of trying to collect the big chunks that were useful. And that's this. That's these books. So what I'm going to walk you through is some of the skills, some of the knowledge, some of the experiences that are still with me even today, even though I'm not a believer and I'm not a church leader anymore. So where should we start? We've got just sort of general skills that you would pick up if you went to any school and got any advanced degree. An MDiv is not a cheap degree. It's not a quick degree. It's work. So you would get the same things you would get in any other sort of general liberal arts degree, like a general understanding of world history, which is just useful as a human being to walk through the world and see yourself as part of a larger story and understand how it fits together. Obviously, our history, beyond being general, included a little bit of specifics about, a lot of specifics about specifically Christian church history. So I can, if you gave me a whiteboard, I could draw you a picture of the family tree and say, you know, these are the roots, these are the influences, and then here's Jesus at the base of the tree, and then you get these branches coming up and out and how they grew and why do we have a million different denominations that believe a different thing and where do we fit on each branch. I can draw that tree. That's, I wouldn't call it a party skill, but it's cool to know. I also learned how to, you can see, like, this is probably 1/50th of the books that I had to read to get my degrees. Maybe 1/100th. Which means I learned how to read. I learned how to study. I learned how to pick up pretty much any book and just work my way through it and educate myself. And I learned how to speak. Have an opportunity to feel comfortable in front of people in a way that a lot of people aren't. You ask people, what's your number one fear? They'll say spiders and public speaking. There are literally people who would rather die than give a speech in front of a group of people. Mm-hmm. That doesn't bother me. Because just that, it got worn off. It's not there anymore. So we got history, we got philosophy, we got, oh, I didn't do philosophy. Here, philosophy. Discourse on Method, Descartes, Lucretius on the nature of the universe, a little bit of Nietzsche. Obviously, these are not the things that they were teaching in seminary, but they were the things that you had to know in order to respond to. So if you're going to be a Christian minister and you're going to share this tradition, you have to understand how that tradition fits in the larger community of thought. So you do have to do some basic history, some basic philosophy. You got to pick up some basic counseling, some interpersonal skills. So I took counseling classes and some basic nonprofit management. Not anything you would, you know, not like a full MBA or anything, but we did have classes on how to manage a small to medium nonprofit that was part of the curriculum.
Sure. Never thought about that part. Yeah. How to raise the money.
Yeah, absolutely. Fundraising, marketing, organizing boards, managing people, building teams, leading projects, all of that stuff. It's all part of the degree. You also pick up, beyond general skills and general knowledge, you pick up some pretty specific Christianity knowledge. So let's talk about here, the saints. I brought along two dead ones and one live one. This is Dame Julian of Norwich. Dame Julian, all is well and all shall be well and all manner of things shall be well. She was a woman in the Middle Ages, lived a hard life, suffered oppression, and yet she found a way to be loving in the middle of it. St. Francis of Assisi, also known as God's Fool, who believed the Bible enough to believe that love meant love meant love meant love, and he tried to live it, got himself in a lot of trouble. Okay. And a modern-day saint, I believe, I would call Nadia Boltz-Weber. Her book here is Pastrix, The Cranky, Beautiful Faith of a Sinner and Saint. She's, I think, a Lutheran. And so my career, or my training, handed me these exemplars, these individuals that stood out so much from the norm that they were worth knowing. That even 1,000 years later, they were worth remembering. And I think there's value in that. I still value these people. And the really weird thing about all of the saints, the ones worth remembering, they were always out there. They were always in trouble. A lot of them got killed. They were always on the edge of theology, and the thing that made them different was they actually believed it. Everyone else says, yes, yes, window dressing, let's get on with our life, I'm a good guy, wave the flag, be part of the tribe. These people said, no, I really believe this, I'm really going to live this, and that means I have to stand against the thing that you're doing, sorry. And it got them in trouble. People worth remembering. I still love them. All right, so we got the saints and the theologians. It's another specifically Christian peoples. We've got so many of them. So many of them. You have to sort of understand how you fit in the larger story. But two that stick with me, one is Karl Barth, and the other is T.F. Torrance. Karl Barth, very, very well known in Christian circles, Presbyterian circles primarily. And T.F. Torrance, much less known, but he was kind of what I would call the first postmodern theologian. He was talking about the theories of Michael Polanyi and how we don't absorb, about how knowledge is not like a thing that you pick up and just know and then build up through logical syllogisms, that knowledge is a thing that you gather by being out in the world and by living it. So how does that apply to the Trinity and the Bible? What these people will do, what these theologians will do, is they're like the brain side of the love side. So the saints are the love side, and the theologians are the brain side, and they're the same kinds of people. They're the people who take it so seriously, they can't just wave the flag and get on with life. They have to try and make it make sense. Problem is, it doesn't make sense. So they go to really interesting lengths to create a mind frame that gets them through and helps them to be good people in a world that doesn't want to be that. So still useful to me. So we got generalized knowledge, we got specialized knowledge, and specialized skills. Obviously, you got to know the Bible front to back, back to front. It's just part of the thing. Again, not the great party trick, but it's like people who know a whole lot of Shakespeare.
Like, it's a lot of crossword.
Yeah, absolutely. 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 The other thing that it helps with is it helps you understanding other literature. Mm-hmm. Because the Bible was so central to Western thought for so long that if you go to a school and ask a kid, what does it mean to turn the other cheek? Mm-hmm. They won't know because they didn't read the Bible. Mm-hmm. But if you've got a grounding in that, then turn the other cheek, walk the extra mile, the writings on the wall, the prodigal returns, I escaped by the skin of my teeth, like all of these phrases that are part of our culture, they're all biblical. So it helps, it does help with crossword puzzles, but it also helps interpreting literature. Also picked up, Latin, Greek, Hebrew. I tried Hebrew twice. I quit both times. I could not do Hebrew. The only thing that I can give you from Hebrew is that Hebrew has very, very few words. It's similar to Native American languages in that it doesn't. English language has a ridiculous number of words. And Greek actually has a very large number of words, which allows them to be more precise and more specific, a little more clinical. Whereas Hebrew, because it has so many fewer words, each word has to carry more freight. So when you read a Old Testament story, there's always about three levels of interpretation available to you. And that's, for me, that's useful to know, because anyone who says this is the way it is, it's functionally not possible if you understand Hebrew. You can't say you know the answer with Hebrew. There's just too much room for layers of complexity.
That's why the Torah scholars spend their whole lives.
Yeah.
I have. Yeah. Them.
Yep. Well,
they never stop talking about it.
Right. Well, and the Torah scholars really have it right, because what's their definition of understanding? It's an ongoing argument. Mm-hmm. Like, let's talk about it. How does this apply? What does it mean? What do you think it means? Let's just argue it out. And that is the process of understanding the Old Testament. They got it right.
It's never done.
Yeah. Okay, so we got Greek and Hebrew. Okay, we'll get rid of those guys. Then we have the historical critical method, which is a method of understanding ancient texts, which means you start with what did it mean in its original context. And the one that, where did I bring? Okay, here. So obviously you've got your, this is a, what do you call it? This is an unpacking of 1 Corinthians. Okay, so 1 Corinthians, the actual book is this big. That it's a millimeter thick, the letter to 1 Corinthians. But this is, you know, an interpretation with some explanations that pull in from other areas to say this is what it meant in context, this is what it meant in society. If you understand who he was speaking to, you understand better what he actually meant. So very, very, very useful for confronting people, again, who take, who think they know the answer and think it's like I should be a bigot. It's easy, the easiest thing in the world to read into a book that's less than a millimeter thick, take whatever you already think and assume that the author meant that. Mm-hmm. And the historical critical method is the tool you use to combat that completely natural human tendency. Still useful. An example of that, Breaking the Code by Bruce Metzger. We've all read, or maybe we haven't all read, I've read probably 30 different books explaining the meaning of Revelation and how Revelation is about to happen and there's going to be actual, like, bugs riding horses with swords coming out of their mouths. And well, Metzger goes through this and does the historical critical method on the book of Revelation. He says that what we call the Revelation of John is it's called an apocalypse, but it really is a style of writing. Just like we have Westerns, and we have romances, and
science fiction,
mm-hmm. You know, all of these, and they all have their own style. They've got their own sort of unwritten rules. You know, fantasy. No one argues that there shouldn't be elves in fantasy. It's part of the thing, and you just have to accept that and understand it. Well, apocalypse was a genre at one time. So if you read the other examples of the genre and see how they work, then you go to this one and you understand, oh, it's symbolism. This means this. This connects with this. Okay, so it's the number 5 doesn't mean literally 5. It means a handful. So what does 10 mean? Couple handfuls. So what does 100 mean? A lot. What does 10,000 mean? A really, really lot. You know? Or, you know, how many days are in a week? 7. Okay, so it's a complete week. So what does the number 7 mean? It means completion or perfection. So what's 7 times 7? 49. Okay, so what's 49? Perfection on top of perfection. Ultimate completeness. So you go through and you read this, and oh, this is the message he was trying to send. He was trying to talk to people who were living through a really crappy time, who were like oppressed by the Romans, and they needed some hope just to get through the day that things would get better. So he created an entire book about how the Romans are going to get theirs one day. And he had to write it in code because the Romans were censoring it, and they would stab you. So he created a book. Well, now we go back. We don't know the genre. We read ourselves into it, and we get all freaked out that we're going to go stand on a hill, and it's going to happen next week, so I better sell my farm. We completely misunderstand it. Still useful. All right. We got historical textual criticism. Okay, just like I can do the family tree for the for the history of Christianity, I can also point you towards scholars who've created a family tree for the history of the text of the Bible. And it's the sort of thing that is only useful if you're really into this stuff. But one of the things that comes up again and again is, how can we trust this book? Like, it's just people who said things to a person who said things to a person. It got written, and then it got copied, and then it got copied. And we've all played the telephone game. You start out with Bob's cool, and you wind up with girl's drool. Like, it's just, it's a mess. How do we even trust that this is real? Well, these people are the answer. These textual critics applied the tools of science to the copies that we have, and we literally have thousands. And they would look at the copies, and they could say, okay, based on the type of papyrus and the lettering, we know that this one's older than this one, so we can sort of arrange them by age, and we're going to give more weight to the earlier ones than the later ones, because the later ones are obviously copied from the earlier ones, so if you've got an error that doesn't match, this one carries more weight. Well, you don't have, like, the original. Nobody has the original. We've got maybe, you know, let's say five really, really old manuscripts. Well, then you look at those five and see the families that came out of them. Well, this family was really pretty loosey-goosey with their interpretation. Okay, so we're going to give this one that was the father, the parent of this particular branch, we're going to give that one a little less weight. And this one over here, all of the ones that came out of it, we got maybe 100 copies. You can tell because they copied the error from the original error. So this guy over here, when he wrote it, because it was probably a guy, honestly, instead of saying 30 days, he said 33. He was just tired. So he wrote 33. Well, then every fellow copy that includes the phrase 33, we know where he copied it from. So you can look at these families and say, okay, this family tree, they took a lot more care, so we're going to give this one a little more weight. When you compare all the different ones that we have and weight them out, what you come to is what we have today, which is an agglomeration of a bunch of tiny fractional texts that create a whole that's pretty darn reliable. I think that's useful. I think it's useful to know that when I pick up the Bible, what I'm reading is pretty much, not precisely, but pretty much what the author intended. I think it saves me from a whole lot of arguments over tits and tats and little niggly details. We can just accept that, this is pretty much what they wrote. Does that mean it's right? No, it means it's what they wrote. Saves you from an argument. And the last one that I still keep with me is liturgy. This is the Book of Common Prayer. These are two modern adaptations. The Book of Uncommon Prayer. This one's very ancient. This one's very new. Book of Common Order. Okay, which shows the I'll handle it. You can take a look at any of these. You can just grab and look at. But it gives you all of the lessons and instructions for how you're supposed to move through a year. The different stories you're supposed to tell and the things you're supposed to perform. The rituals.
Okay. Did you say which denomination you were educated in?
I started out in the non-denominational, kind of fundamentalist. Mm-hmm. More evangelical than fundy, but I was pretty hardcore. And then I moved over to the National Association, so they were congregationalists, but a little more conservative than the UCC.
Okay.
So yeah, you're welcome to take a look at these.
Most things be different. The various orders of the year would be different in the different denominations.
Absolutely, absolutely. They are all different, but they're all built out of the same family tree. It all originally comes from the Romans and the Eastern Orthodox, who created these calendars, in order to tell a story through the year, who took the situation around them, took the ancient pagan festivals and said, oh, you can still do Christmas. You can still do Yule if you want to do Yule, but guess what? Now it's about Jesus. you can still have your fertility rite on the dawn of spring, but now it's going to be about Jesus. So they took these and they turned them into an annual calendar to teach people how to move not just through the year, but through their life.
Because people were illiterate.
Right. Right. And same with stained glass. What's stained glass? It's a comic book for people who can't read. Yep. And then also, you don't just move through the seasons of the year. You move through the seasons of life. So they trained me in liturgies. Yeah, go for it.
Thank you.
liturgies for birth, liturgies for naming, liturgies for rites of passage from you were a boy and now you're a man, you were a girl and now you're a woman, laying on of hands, you were a child and now you're an adult. You were an adult, but now you are ordained by laying on of hands to a specific purpose. You know, retirement, you were the person who did this job, and now you're the elder who oversees the community without any responsibilities except just to sit there and be smart. That's your whole job now. Okay? And now you're gone, and we need to celebrate your life. Like, all of these things, it's all part of the things that they taught. Okay, so that's the entire MDiv in a nutshell.
Laid out.
Right. For us. From beginning to end. So now what I'm doing, I did the winnowing, I did the sifting, what's left is the simmer. If you do some cooking, you understand the point of simmering is to cook off the extra and concentrate what's there. Because there are still things here that, good, you've heard me, I hope, feel excited about some of the things that are here. We can concentrate them and create something new. I wouldn't want to eat an entire bag of tomatoes, but I love pasta sauce. So you take this, you concentrate it, and you create something worthwhile. That's what I'm trying to do with my life. So I thank you for letting me share. And what I can say, here we've already done these, what I can say, how much time do we... Oh, we got a half hour. We're good. Let me leave you with a story and then open it up to questions. And you can ask literally about any of these books or anything else. I don't care. There's a place in Italy called Sardinia. And Sardinia has nothing about it that's exceptional. Except that it's a cool place in Italy. But what makes it exceptional is that it has the highest concentration of centenarians in the world. There are more centenarians, 100 years or older, in Sardinia than there are in the entire continent of North America. And they tried to investigate, what is it about this place? Like, do they have great waters, the Fountain of Youth in Sardinia? Is that where we get to go? It's like, no, it's not the water. Well, what do they eat? Do they eat really good food? Do they have that Mediterranean diet? No, they eat ravioli with cheese in it, and they eat it like piles of it. You know, they drink wine, and they drink ravioli, so there's not... Some of them are fat and some of them are skinny, and so it's not the food. Is it the weather? Well, it's in Italy, like it's nice, but it's not any nicer than any other place in Italy. What is it about these people? So they went to interview them, all these centenarians, and what they discovered was it was impossible to interview one of them alone. Because when you sat down, inevitably, at a kitchen table, inevitably with food, it would also inevitably include an aunt or an uncle or a daughter or a cousin or a neighbor or many of them gathered around the table helping this old person tell their story. See? Because they didn't see them as an old person. This was their elder. And they weren't alone. They were part of a community. That's, for me, that's what this whole thing was designed to create. That's why they taught me this. I am good for nothing. Can I be a psychologist? No, I don't have enough training to be a psychologist. They gave me just an entry level on counseling. Can I run my own business? No, I don't have an MBA. They gave me just enough to run a small nonprofit. You know, can I go out and teach a class on history? No, I don't know enough history to be a professional, but I know enough history to answer someone's question when they don't know where they fit in the world. They gave me just enough skills to be the leader of a small to medium nonprofit that was designed to help people love each other. That is the entire purpose of this degree. So would I recommend it to anyone? Absolutely not. Because you're not good for anything else. You were created and fashioned into this one thing, and if you can't be that thing anymore, sorry, tough luck. I answer phones for a living. I answer emails. I'm in customer service, and I'm darn good at it. But, you know,
you got trained for that.
Yes, because I got trained for that. And people, they call me up, and they're like, I always feel like you just have the time for me. Everyone else, I call, and they feel like they're so busy. I'm good at it, but am I getting paid for it? You know, not as much. I get paid half what I used to be, you know, when I was a preacher. I'm really good. Yeah. You know, so if you want to be that, what I suggest you do is go audit some classes. Because there is knowledge here that is worth keeping. We keep people around who do nothing but study ancient Russian literature. Because it's good to know that thing. Well, guess what? I'm the guy who did that, but for Jesus stuff. We keep those people around. Those are good for a reason. But is that guy going to, make a ton of money? Would I recommend my son go out and stud Russian literature? No. So, if you're interested in it, audit classes. There's a lot of good stuff here. Okay? But don't invest your life in it.
Speaking of Jesus stuff, I noticed one of your books is Josephus.
Yes.
Now, was he a historian at the time that
yes.
Jesus was supposed to live?
Yes.
As I recall reading something about all he had to say about Jesus was Jesus, son of Joseph, Jesus of Nazareth, son of Joseph. But later there were things added into his record, pious fraud, that Jesus was the Christ.
Yes, yes.
So does that book cover some of this?
Oh, for sure, for sure. It's pretty well known that that Josephus was overwritten by Christians who came after, who said, oh, look, see, he was real. It's in the history book, you know, that they added things in. And it was the same textual critical method that helped us have a Bible. It's the same textual critical method that helped us have Josephus. So just like we can look at a text and say, okay, this variant says blah, 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 and it's 73 characters long. And this variant is only 53 characters long. Which one is true? Well, it's probably the shorter one is more accurate, because it's more likely that someone would come to their holy book and add an explanation than that they would cross something out. Mm-hmm. You know, little things like that. Somebody took the time to investigate and figure it out. How do scribal errors happen? And we can use that to look at Josephus and say, yeah, he probably was not on the Jesus bandwagon. So if you cut out that piece, what's left is there was a guy named Jesus. That's about it.
So there's a group of biblical scholars now who say that there isn't much evidence that Jesus ever existed as a single individual, that the Christian church created what we read about Jesus in the Bible.
And that's a possibility, and honestly, it really doesn't bother me, because the word Bible doesn't mean book. The word for Bible, the word book in Greek is biblion. And the plural of biblion is biblia. So we have a holy biblia. We have a holy books. And the original people knew that when they put it together. The book of Job. The book of Matthew. The letter to the Corinthians. These are all individual pieces written by a person for a cause. And so to take that idea and extrapolate a little further and say, well, what if Jesus was actually a collection of a bunch of different rabbis who said a bunch of cool stuff, who didn't necessarily agree with each other, but they took the best and sort of collated it into one super guy? Like, maybe. I don't know. Does that hurt the story, really? Like, it does, obviously, if you think he was, like, the savior of the universe and son of God and everything. But if you think he was just a person, either he was a really smart person who said some cool things and some horrible things, or you think he was a series of people who said some cool things and some horrible things. But either way, all of it was good enough to preserve through blood and tears to hand down to us. So it's literature. That's the cool thing about being a UU, is you don't have a book, which means you've got all the books. They're all your books, including this one.
Reminds me of Servetus, who got into trouble because he read the Bible in Spanish, he was Spanish, and in Latin, in Aramaic, and in Hebrew, I think were the three languages he read it. And he had one that was totally illegal at the time to do that. And he read the whole thing, and he said, in all three languages, and said, there's a thing in here about the Trinity, and became a Unitarian in his philosophy and got burned at the stake as a result by Calvin, of all people.
Yeah, Calvin was intense.
He and Calvin were not buddies. They had debated with him. Calvin really had it in for him anyway.
Well, and that story repeated itself throughout history. I mean, we talk about a family tree. Well, you should really talk as like a bundle of stalks that are forcibly tied together every once in a while, but continually shoot off and escape. Christianity has always been a bundle of orthodoxies and heresies growing up together, and people trying to decide which one is the right answer. It's from the very start. It has always been that, which is why I think it's good that we have four books.
Which is why it's done by people who are like that.
Right. But we've got, even at the very beginning, we got four different Gospels. Now, there's a ton of agreement within them, but there's also places that they're pretty different. And that's okay, because it's always been a human story.
I'm kind of curious how they handle like sensitive topics in the Bible that are, what do they suggest you do? Just for an example, my parents started down getting more religious at one point, and they were given a really nice Bible by my uncle, and they decided to sit down and read cover to cover.
Right.
You can probably guess how far they got.
Yeah.
Not very far.
Yes. If you're lucky, maybe to Deuteronomy.
It was Genesis. They started going down the incest with the daughters. And they, suddenly this holy man, the daughters decided it was okay to have his child, and they're like, okay.
Yep, and we're done.
So there's things peppered throughout the Bible that are, by today's standards, would be at best immoral, and at worst, super illegal. It's never brought up in church. So there's like holes that are always left out. Do they talk specifically about that in the seminary, about the trouble spots?
Oh, for sure. And that's, if you want to take someone who is, a fundamentalist and break them, send them to a liberal seminary where, they will be forced to confront these issues, that there are places there, try and reconcile all of the resurrection narratives. There's only four of them, but you can't make them all fit.
Right.
Try and reconcile the difference between, an Old Testament God who seems pretty vicious and seems to have a lot more in common with Zeus.
Right.
Like Zeus, you don't get offended when Zeus acts like an idiot. Because he's clearly just, he's a man with big boy pants on.
Yeah.
And the Old Testament God acts like that sometimes. But there are moments of beauty. There are moments of transcendence in the middle of that. And then Jesus takes that a step further and he says, well, you've heard it said, but I say, which is part of what got him killed. Like, he was reinterpreting and expanding and opening. Well, isn't that the process of human growth? Haven't we been doing that from the start? Isn't he just one more step in that process that we're continuing this day? So we could look at him and say, yeah, there's some stuff in there I don't agree with either. But we keep growing.
What sort of teaching in your school did they have about Eastern religions? Because they seem to take a totally different approach.
Yeah.
Human nature.
Yep. I like the analogy of the person who took a major in Russian Russian literature. Like, in order to understand Russian literature, you're going to have to understand broadly the rest of the story, but you're going to focus on Russian literature. Mm-hmm. Well, and we had a comparative religions class, so you get vaguely the rest of the story, but the purpose of the thing is to create a keeper of a tradition. Like, that's why they spend all the money to create the college, to, they got to keep the thing going. So you're creating people who will keep the tradition going.
How did you feel about that?
At the start, I was really proud of it. I was glad to be the keeper of what I thought was the world's most beautiful tradition. Over time, I became more frustrated. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until after I left that I finally said, I don't believe this anymore. Mm-hmm. But looking back now, at the other traditions, I see them all as part of a larger human story, and I think there's good to be found in a lot of places.
In your study seminary, did they talk about the parts of the Bible that could have been parts of the Bible but didn't make the cut?
The schools that I went to did not do a ton of work on it, and part of the first school I went to was too conservative to do a lot of work on that. The second school would have done work on it, but it was still pretty new. Mm-hmm. You've got what's his name? Is it Bart Ehrman? I think there's a fairly recent book about the Gospel of Judas, and and we're still uncovering new layers of stuff out of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Like, those are still fairly, from an archaeological perspective, those are still fairly fresh documents for us. So we didn't get a ton of exploration of the Gnostic Gospels, except that they existed. But again, if you're being trained as the keeper of a tradition, taking time to spend a ton of study on the heresies of your tradition, like, it was mentioned, like, I have to understand what Gnosticism is, but did we take the time to really dig into it and read it? No.
I had an aunt who had a little book called The Book of Ruth.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder where that came from. Was that one of the Gnostic?
Well, I don't know that one in particular, but there's hundreds. Mm-hmm. Yeah. My favorite modern... Yeah, I mean, you can think of them like fan fiction. That people, they loved a story, and they looked at the story, and they said, well, there's missing this whole bit. Like, he's born, yay, that's cool.
Yeah.
And then he's just... nothing, and then he's 33. Like, what happened in this whole, like, there's got to be something cool. Mm-hmm. So they, make a story about the things that he did. Well, there's a modern-day guy that did that, and it's called Lamb. It's a modern-day guy who wrote the story of that 30-year window in there.
Oh, yeah.
Where...
it's sort of comic.
Yeah, well, it's fantastic.
History.
Yeah, yeah, it's hilarious. Because it's the story of Jesus and his best buddy Biff. And Jesus, their opening scene is Jesus is sitting with his friend Biff, and Biff is picking up, birds or fish or some little critter. Like, he picks up a critter, and then he goes, whack! And he smacks it in the head, and he kills it, and then he hands it to Jesus, and Jesus goes, and it comes back to life. And this is the game that they're playing. Like, like, that's, he's, it's, I don't even remember the dude's name who wrote Lamb. But if you're interested in that kind of stuff, it's very, very good.
And do you imagine that 2,000 years from now, someone will think that's one of the Gospels?
I would hope.
4,000 years.
Gospel according to Biff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I sure hope not. I hope that we're making enough. If you look at what passed for comedy, 1,000 years ago, and what we call comedy today, I feel like we're getting better at this stuff. So hopefully we can continue to get better.
So one of the things I was thinking about when I saw the title of your talk is I haven't seen her now for years, but I had a friend who was a Lutheran pastor.
Mm-hmm.
And she talked about how seminary training and fundamentalism were just not compatible.
Right.
That you learn in the seminary the source of all of these different
yep.
books.
Yep.
And the way she talked about it to me, my Bible knowledge is pretty thin, but
mm-hmm.
you know, here's tort law.
Mm-hmm.
That's this section. And here's
right.
the propaganda of the Jews telling everybody, we'll
right.
slaughter your town if you treat us badly. And
right.
you know, and just the different purposes and,
yep.
and audiences of the different books.
Yes.
And her complaint was about evangelical pastors in what she considered unschooled traditions.
Yes.
Who hadn't had any training and were just putting out there what they thought it was all about.
Right. Yep.
That was a big, big beef of hers, which
yep.
you guys remember, Margot Peterson. She spoke at our church a couple times.
But yep.
anyway, so that's something that's obvious from your discussion, too.
Yeah, I agree entirely. 100%.
So do you think it would be, in some ideal world, would it be possible to constitute an education that wouldn't spend 5-6 years... doing all this and coming out with a great wealth of knowledge, but could you have done it in a couple of years and studied some science on the side? Some oriental history.
Yeah. It's possible. The problem is the motivation. Mm-hmm. Like it takes a ton of effort to create and maintain a seminary, and the only reason culturally that exists is to perpetuate the tradition.
And then some ministers for these small town
right.
communities that don't want to go to the work.
So do you miss ministering?
Oh, yes.
So you thought about, you know, going back and getting your UU chops and becoming a UU minister?
It's a possibility that... Mostly what I've been trying to do in the meantime is just sort of get my feet under me. Yeah. You know, like for a while
it
I was...
Had to be a pretty...
Like going through a jarring...
Yeah, yeah.
Jarring transition.
Jarring.
Yep, yep. You know, I went through a divorce for a while. I was basically homeless. Like, it was hard for a while. And it's been, you know, 3-4 years now. I've got a job where I'm respected and I feel like I'm good mm-hmm. at it and I've...
Make a living.
Yeah, like I make enough to get by. It's like, okay, now I can breathe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now what's the next step? You know?
Did your wife feel like it was a kind of a bait and switch? She married a minister and then she got you?
Well, you'd have to ask her. I think there was probably some of that going on, but I've got enough issues of my own. I don't need to add more on top of that. I'm definitely not going to blame Jesus for my mistakes.
No. I have a cousin who's she's always been quite religious, and she got married to he's a cop, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And at first he was with her, and he evolved into, he's Unitarian now, and in a very outspoken atheist,
mm-hmm.
and they're not doing well.
Yeah. Mm.
That was definitely a bait and switch.
That's what she feels. She feels it was a complete bait and switch. But he just, you know, he
evolved.
He evolved. He changed. And
right. But I am sticking around for lunch. I'll be hanging out for a while. So
where do you live?
In Janesville. Yep. So happy to talk more. Anybody who'd like to.
Good. Thank you. And you get out to Sauk City once a month? Or?
No, it's like 6 times a year.